Hello and welcome back. I overslept, so I missed all of the breaking news. If you're joining us, we are live right now on X, YouTube, and Rumble. If you're watching the replay, obviously we will be up on Spotify and wherever else you get your podcasts. If you like what we're doing and would like us to keep going, hit the links in the description or visit ddgeopolitics.com. Thank you so much for your support on the Substack. We have a ton of new articles and a ton more on the way, I'm sure, especially after this morning. Murat, how are you? I'm feeling very low energy.
I'm good. Happy June. It's my birthday month. How are you doing?
Sarius. It's the producer's birthday month, too. We are in Gemini season, the worst season of the zodiac. You, Trump, and Aria, the producer, and my mother.
I am a member of one of the most persecuted demographics.
Persecuted, rightfully so. It's a terrible sign. It's the worst sign on the zodiac. Anyway, moving right along. I had a whole show prepped, but Ukraine decided to play jihad, and there went the show. So what? I guess what I did have was talking about the peace talks that were going to happen tomorrow. And obviously the Russian terror attack or the Ukrainian terror attack in Bryansk. So why don't we, I guess, start there before we get into all the madness. Here's what we have on Bryansk.
Там кричат все.
Блин, неужели не предупредили, что мост обвалился?
Какой-нибудь сос, я не знаю, что. А как этот мост обвалился?
Дети маленькие.
Там дети. Дети кричат. Там дети кричат.
Подъедьте кто-нибудь, там дети маленькие.
At least 7 people dead, 40 people injured. In one of the videos, you can hear, not in that compilation, but you can hear the sounds of babies crying. Apparently, the target was a bridge in the Vygonishki district of Bryansk, Russia. The entire crew was killed. I'm not sure if there are still people trapped, but I'm going to guess that there are not. Obviously, it is being suggested that Ukrainian sabotage units were involved. We had thought that this was it. So what were your thoughts on this attack before this morning?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not inclined, I'm not programmed to think of false flag every time something happens.
I don't either. Yeah, I didn't think it was.
I think it's lazy. Well, I mean, just even in general. And so with this, you know, at face value, it certainly would seem that, you know, if anyone would do this, it would be Ukraine. And, you know, the drone attack aside, this would look like the asymmetrical warfare strategy, right? Like, you know, you have, you know, something you do kind of as part of official military policy, and then you have the stuff off the books, which is kind of you know, in the shadows and done clandestinely. And who, you know, I don't have any information to say one way or the other, but you know, just kind of, I'm just going off, you know, just rational deduction. But yeah, I mean, that's what I would think. I'm not sure Russia needs to do false flags at this point, right?
I think that was my reaction when somebody, I think somebody asked me, like, do you think it's a false flag? I was like, not a false flag. Russia doesn't need them.
Russia doesn't need them at this point. Russia's, you know, false flags aren't beyond Russia, but I mean, what would Russia be needing to manufacture consent for? You know, if Russia, if you do a false flag, it means you're needing, you know, people to be under. I just don't see why Russia would do that. But, you know, on Ukraine's end, you have this, you know, this pervading threat of asymmetric warfare and, you know, that, you know, the insurgency and, you know, the way that sort of wears down, you know, your enemy when they expect this kind of ongoing issue, like a thorn in the side. But from Russia's end, they're winning the war. I don't see why they would do a false flag.
Yeah, Russia doesn't harm its own people. That's just not Russian style. Especially over the last 3 years, that would be very much out of Russian character. I slept late in the last time zone on Earth, well, like third to last time zone on Earth, so I missed everything. So Aria was kind enough to put this compilation together, and good morning.
Вот он, копчер опять взлетел. Откуда взлетает, ничего не понятно, блядь.
Дрон взлетает из этого, из КамАЗа. Дрон летит, его сбивают эти.
Оце так файно виглядає зараз аеродром Білая. Стратегічна ворожа авіація.
Будка сгоревшая, нахуй. Тягача не видать, нахуй.
What the hell is going on in the chat? But people are like upset that I said it's not Russia's style to kill their own citizens. That upset you? Okay. Guys, it's okay if you don't watch the stream. Just go outside. It's okay. Take your iodine pills and go outside or get banned from the channel. I don't know what else to say to you. And then someone else says, I know what's going on in Russia. You think we don't have admin in Russia? Of course we have admin in Russia. Calm down.
Together, I had retweeted that very first clip. I mean, the guy filming it, his commentary was just hilarious. I mean, he's just cussing the whole time. But it's amazing. We're able to have you know, just, you know, tons and tons of clips right available right off the bat now, you know, during warfare, you know, with layman commentary come attached with it.
So we have a major attack today, well into U.S. or well into Russian soil. Allegedly, Ukrainians are saying it took 18 months to plan this attack. I'm very underwhelmed and unimpressed for an 18-month planned attack. But from what I can gather is there's Boxer bread trucks near the airports and that FPV drones flew out of these trucks. And civilians also attempted to stop the drones. Such Russian behavior. Civilians jumped in and tried to stop the drones from taking off, which is very Russian. So very kudos to that. Kudos to them and brave on their part. But Ukrainians are obviously celebratory today. I think that most Russian channels agree that a small amount of planes were taken out at around up to 10 heavy bombers. We have some
civilians that were coming in. Was that the cops? Because in the first clip, he's like, oh, look, I think it's the cops that are shooting. So I think that's what he was referring to.
Cops. People were trying to defend the bases, which is... It's tremendous. It's awesome to see that like people got up and were like, well, then I better like jump in.
Firing at it, like just with their firearms.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, by any means necessary. It's a drone warehouse. Now, if you've listened to this spaces, Zaganil actually talks about this a lot, that Ukrainians are utilizing their civilians and civilian properties to build drones. So civilians are building these sort of small drones. China actually recently banned all of the drone parts and whatever pieces and piecemeal they were getting from China. So they will not be getting into Ukraine anymore. So hopefully that kind of puts the damper on this. They've geolocated the warehouses. There are some photos of the damages to the Tu-95s.
And so this was an 18-month operation. This is like when you have a specific play, you know, that you save for the end of the game, you know, in sports or, was this their big one that they were saving in case they needed it? And I mean, the reports I'm reading, you know, are just the narrative being pushed on Twitter is that, you know, a third of the Russian Air Force has been taken out. That's what, you know, NAFO's Twitter is saying. I'm not saying that the Russian side has confirmed that that's what happened, but certainly there's a side that's claiming that, you know, we had a big punch to give and it's landed, you know, and took out everything that we were intending to take out.
I think that I'm going to cope a little bit here, but I think that this is actually, it sucks and it's horrible. It's a terrible optics and whatnot, but an 18 month plan for this, and this is it. This is what you came up with after a year and a half. That's a good sign that there's not really a whole lot brewing over there. And also, what do you think about the timing? I mean, we've had the last piece right after following the last peace talks, we got my new favorite video of Trump, which I don't know what the hell's the matter with this guy. But obviously Ukraine had sabotaged that conversation as well. That came right after the large drone attack that almost killed Putin. And now Ukraine does this on the eve. Peace talks are like the Russian delegation was in the air while all of this was sort of transpiring. They landed like while you and I were in that space about a half an hour ago. So what do you think about the timing to disrupt, to derail these peace talks? I thought that it was Russia that didn't want peace. Now I'm
seeing, so everyone always just makes an excuse for themselves to escalate, you know, right? And I don't know, you know, with Trump, is it like he's, you know, setting it up to make it easier to be on Russia's part, or is he actually just that dumb and doesn't know what to say in regards to Putin? I mean, it seems like, you know, this operation was coordinated and, you know, they were, you know, this was going to be a go. I think Russia once again has another big punch. Another big card to play, and it probably was waiting for, you know, whatever big operation that Ukraine had to give it to let it happen, and now Russia can come back with with you know, with the gloves off, you know, whatever it had next. So I think each side, you know, has its next card to play. You know, particularly Russia. I don't know how many more 18-month operations Ukraine has, you know, left in it, but yeah. I mean, we'll probably see we'll probably see something epic from Russia. This one apparently was epic. I mean, I am seeing reports that this was a attack that was unprecedented in its mm-hmm. in its scale. And so, you know, this in itself was a historic sort of maneuver, and so. We'll see how Russia responds.
It was very much intricate. There were warehouses inside of Russia. Ukraine has come out and said that they were some of the sites in which they were preparing were right located right next door to FSB offices, like kind of rubbing salt to the wound. I've heard other rumors that some originated from the Baltics, of course. Where else? But and maybe Poland. Poland has started evacuating border villages. So a lot of things moving around. What do you think about, I think it was Axios that changed their headline, or it wasn't a headline, I'm sorry. It was like a little blurb that said, you know, the U.S. was informed, and then they changed it to say the United States has said they were not informed. I think the lady doth protest too much. Last week, Trump, Truth Social. What do you do on Truth Social? Do you truth something out? Do you post it? Are you socialing it out?
Yeah.
I guess his post on Truth Social from like a week ago or the 27th, 4 days ago, said, 5 days ago, said, what Vladimir Putin doesn't realize is that if it weren't for me, lots of really bad things would have already happened to Russia. And I mean, really bad. He's playing with fire.
And, you know, this notion that like Ukraine is now acting unilaterally, you know, that the U.S. didn't know about this and that Ukraine just went ahead and said, all right, screw it, let's go. We were just wondering the same question about Israel and in regards to Iran. You know, would Israel just go ahead and act unilaterally? And Trump already recused himself from that, right? So what I'm seeing is Trump or the U.S. just being like, no, they're just going on their own way. Yeah, I don't know anything about that. I don't support it. And so, you know, Ukraine, Israel, what's going on here? Like, you know, are all these powers meant to be acting unilaterally? I don't buy it. So I mean, depending on them changing the headline, I personally don't buy it at all.
Yeah, me neither. I think Ukraine has big mouths. They're very unprofessional. They probably came out and were like, yeah, we told the Americans. And then the White House was like, don't post, like, don't put that in there.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Like, you already showed your hand. You said you threatened Putin directly. Very bad things will happen to Russia. And now very bad things happen to Russia.
I think this administration just like throw all these other parties under the bus rather than, you know, appear to be duplicitous or appear to be in the works with the war. But they honestly just look like fools. I mean, they look like Mr. Magoo.
Ukraine looks like Mr. Magoo. I think it looks
the Trump administration looks like Mr. Magoo when, you know, they try to
have their vassals in line. Their two vassals are just completely rogue. Like that's the kind of thing that, like, if you say you knew, then at least you were in on it and it was sanctioned or whatever. If you say you didn't know, your vassal has gone rogue. So what are we doing to either to kind of fix that is another question. I mean, Israel does this all the time. And I think that Ukraine might even be taking some cues from Israel. I mean, Israel could get away with anything. So if Israel can get away with it, I'm sure Ukraine thinks that they could push their envelope a little bit further as well.
Has a little bit of a better position in that regard than Israel, because Ukraine gets to say, well, our existential problem is yours, because if we go down, they're on your doorstep. It's a little bit more than what Israel can say. But yeah, I agree that Ukraine's taking their cue from Israel.
Yeah, Ukraine definitely has the advantage in that sort of, we are battling your historical existential enemy, and the hordes of Mongols and orcs will come over the Urals and they'll kill all of the Poles and the good central Ukrainians. So yeah, but I'm not buying that they didn't know. I'm not buying, and I love the fact that they did it with Chinese piecemeal drones. Like, it's just, it's insane. The whole thing is just bonkers. I think that a few people in the chat said they're embarrassed for Russia. I'm I'm not. I don't think that it's, I mean, it is a little embarrassing, but I just don't, it's war.
If they did it with Chinese piecemeal drones, I mean, I suppose it's, I mean, that like, probably is more of, you know, a win than if, like you said, you had to need this latest state of the art, you know, to do it. But, you know, again, how much of the war is this really going to turn? Is it this extended war?
That's the thing. You have to take the step back and say, what's the strategic advantage? Did Ukraine get did Ukraine gain any strategic footage or footing or advantage out of this? And the answer is no.
The headline I saw on Geopolitics Reddit was or it was from the Wall Street Journal, but that Ukraine is trying to, you know, make a pitch to Gen Z, or you know, incentivize Gen Z to conscript for the war. That's you know, not a strong sign. It's a worrying sign. They're already having major demographic issues.
So they're advertising on Minecraft, Murat,
right.
And Roblox. They're advertising on Minecraft and Roblox. So this sort of this is a huge operation, but it's sort of a desperate operation. So this sort of desperate operation, coupled with what we know of the propaganda inside of Ukraine and the consistent kidnappings, that this doesn't bode well for Ukraine anyway.
Yeah. It's I mean, demographically, it's a catastrophe. Everyone that could get out already did. And so I don't know what percent, you know, of the fighters were, you know, Gen X or millennial, but, you know, you wanted to avoid, you know, digging into, you know, the Zoomers.
Exactly.
So I don't know how many, of that generation is still like out there available and kind of pondering, you know, mulling it over in their head to still sign up or not.
I agree. That's a really good point. And it's interesting because when they were doing the conscriptions, they kept raising the age. They were never lowering the limit. That was like the very last, that was going to be like the like last ditch effort. They kept on raising. And obviously the average got up, the average of people at the front got almost to 50, I think. It might have even gotten above 50, but I know it got into the 40s. But they were very reluctant to lower the age. They kept on raising it because they didn't want to dip into that pool of younger Ukrainians, and now they're advertising on these sort of platforms, which are usually used for human trafficking, by the way, but neither here nor there.
Sorry, the not to push you on the spot, but the total estimated dead from Ukraine's end, do you know where we're at so far?
Probably a million.
Yeah, and most of those coming, you know, from a generation that already was kind of lagging behind the total numbers compared to women. So, you know, these parts of the world don't already, you know, already have a bit of a weak sex ratio, you know, men per women, et cetera. And so like the, you know, that sort of blow to Ukraine is just.
Amen. And before we move on, how much of this do you think there was? Someone said 1.3 million Ukrainians. I didn't realize it was that high. How much of a chance do you think that like Russians were actually in on this? I feel like there has to be probably some modicum of collaboration, traitorous collaboration.
On the drone attack?
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't put it at too high of a percent. Because then it's like, if you're collaborating on each move, then... And then, you know, it's all like kind of a puppet show. I don't think they knew about this one. I think that, you know, especially, you know, for 18 months, maybe they knew something was planned, but I don't think this was, you know, like if you're asking me, like if they knew, like they just let it happen, like October
7th. No, I mean, like maybe like a onesie twosie guy was bribed and was like, you know what I mean? Like there were some insider help for the Ukrainians on a smaller
scale. I suppose that happens anymore.
Not that like Putin knew and allowed this to happen. I would never say that.
Sure. Okay. Yeah. I mean, in that case, perhaps, I mean, that sort of stuff just happens in every attack, I think, probably.
Yeah.
Nowadays, but.
Well, where do we go from here? I know that some bombers took off already. Russia usually doesn't retaliate on like a immediate turnaround. They usually build up a nice package, but there were some bombers that took off. I could check the alerts right now. Very minor air alerts. But where do we go from here? What do you think the retaliation will be like? What do you think about tomorrow's peace talks? What, I guess maybe just give a little bit of a prediction, but I'm so scared to predict anything now.
Tomorrow's peace talks will probably be, you know, a whole lot of nothing, but it'll just be another like, oh, you know, never mind. The retaliation, I don't expect nukes. I saw a little bit of chatter about that, but I don't think this, if there wasn't for Kursk, I don't think that it will be for this. I could be wrong about that, but if it wasn't used then, I don't think it'll be used here. So that's kind of the main thing, probably the main question that people have, like in terms of what Russia's response will be. We'll see, you know, if they roll out some impressive, you know, barrage, but, you know, we don't have to worry about nukes, I think. We're still safe from nukes.
Well, the problem is that their nuclear doctrine does allow for nukes to fly right now. According to Russian nuclear doctrine, nukes could be flying and should be flying right now. So this is the problem when you kind of paint yourself into these corners. And Ukraine keeps on trying to explore the red line. There has to be a red line. And I agree with your assessment that Kursk was, should have been the hair trigger or the tripwire, and it wasn't. And now this feels like it's another uptick in the escalation ladder. And I feel like that a response has to be very swift and very final. Someone mentioned Andrei Martyanov, who is the greatest, often says terrorism is the weapon of the weak. It's exactly how I view it. If I see attacks like this, these sort of death by a thousand cuts attempts, I always think that it's actually good news. That's just how, maybe I'm a cope artist. I don't know. I do love that copium, I guess. But we'll obviously be talking about this all week on Twitter and in spaces and trolling people and whatnot. But we'll move on to our next segment, which is about Israel. I was trolling around the interwebs as I live online and saw this ridiculous video.
Tourists and school children are going on field trips in Israel, but not to museums. Instead, to watch the destruction of Gaza, known as resilience tourism in Israel, but as genocide tourism internationally.
Well, we were a mile and a half or so from 300,000 people who were being forcibly starved to death by the Israelis.
That was Matthew Ho, a former U.S. State Department official and U.S. Marine veteran, who recently took this tour in Sderot, where visitors use coin-operated binoculars to peek into Gaza.
An Israeli school field trip showed up, and these children, they're teenagers, they came from 2 hours away to come and watch the genocide.
The tours are also done in English for international visitors and are included in Birthright Israel trips for Jewish Americans and for all Israeli school children.
The population sees it as entertainment, where you have this complete dismissal of the Palestinians as human beings, but part of their school curriculum.
And it doesn't just stop at the observation platforms. Reportedly, boat tours have been organized to view the destruction of Gaza, sparking outrage worldwide.
And I'm not going to moral grandstand on it. I'd be like, oh. But like, I think that this says a lot about the mentality of Israelis. And then you mentioned that you had seen this before. So why don't you tell us a little bit about that and why it's significant?
Yeah, well, genocide tourism doesn't strike me as anything that new, because it does capture something fascinating. Like, it captures something in people that fascinates us. But so what you're referring to, you know, I was telling you about in Armenia and Azerbaijan. I had heard about a viewing deck. Because whenever you retake land or conquer land, you're celebrating a victory over some land, so people will come and try to visit that area as sort of, you know, in a touristy way to check out what's being developed, you know, or whatever. And so in a sense, you know, the morbid aspect of that is that you're making a tourist destination out of land that was just cleansed of its, you know, previous inhabitants. And so in addition to that sort of, you know, tourism, In a more morbid and kind of similar to this way, I had heard of an observation deck where next to the border you you could just like a safari just sort of view any Armenians that may be there across the border. So that's kind of just how it is. It's like you go there to be next to the border to view what's going on and quite possibly see a few in the wild. And of course, it's a demarcated border still between Armenia and Azerbaijan, so it's a somewhat of a wild area. But yeah, I mean, for this is just this is somewhat a. I mean, I'm surprised they have kids, to watch an ongoing war. The Armenia-Azerbaijan one is more of a,
yeah, like these are the results, and look at what we've won. This is like, you want to watch it happen, kids? Kids, you want to see violence?
And it's there's a danger in for the population to be around that if you want them to kind of observe and witness it. So it is shocking, and you could play stupid games and win super prizes there too. If there's collateral any kind of violence that spills over. But how do we know how prevalent that is? I mean, that clip is a little bizarre.
I mean, they've had they've always had the Sderot sort of movie theater, they call it, where they go and watch Israel bomb. Like, Israel will let them know when they're going to bomb the Palestinians, and they can go to the top of this certain hill and watch it. That's been around for decades. But this is the first I've heard where people are actually going to pay, like, to look into those binocular things, those lookout things. I just thought it was interesting. Not because of the morality of it. Hummus said it's not that bad because we're letting you watch it. That's a really good point. It's a desensitization. If it was so bad, we would hide it. If it was so wrong, we would hide it. We're proud of it. This is a good thing. This is the righteous thing. And the reason why I kind of wanted to use that to segue into this Israel segment is because it shows more of this sort of war profiteering and this sort of desensitization that makes more war profiteering possible. So what we had this week, and people were watching, we've been talking about it and writing about the privatization of both the Ukraine and Israel or Gaza extensively on our Substack, and we've touched on it a lot in the streams. This week we had a huge debacle because one of the companies that privatized the aid in Gaza actually pretty much came as close to collapsing as possible without fully collapsing. And I think that this kind of shows this sort of path that we're on, indicative of that genocide tourism video. And then we see what's happening with the aid in Gaza as well. So leading up to this GHF, Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. So I just want to give you guys some background. In late 1993, or in late 2023, there was a forum in Israel and called the Mikveh Israel Forum. And like-minded officials and military officers, private business contractors got together to figure out how they could take over the aid processes in Gaza. Eventually, they settled on using private contractors in order to circumvent the UN. So the idea the entire time was to get the UN out of there as well as make money. We can check off a bunch of boxes at one time. Throughout 2024, they started getting their support from Israeli political leaders and military commanders, and then they discovered Mr. Philip Riley, or Raleigh, depends on when you meet him because he uses different names. But Philip Riley, who operates under the alias Philip Raleigh, is a former director of the CIA Special Activities Center, which is the CIA's paramilitary, the covert paramilitary division. So throughout 2024, he worked as a lobbyist between the United States and Israeli officials to develop a plan for Gaza's aid distribution. And then he went on to establish Safe Reach Solutions, which is a private military contractor, and they're tasked with securing the aid hubs. In March 2024, that's when the 11-week blockade began. I don't know if you guys remember. And then by April 2024, UNRWA had completely collapsed and been banned from Israel. And then after that, they started making it increasingly more difficult and impossible for the private NGOs, such as Doctors Without Borders, to get in. In late 2024, Israel and United States officials began quietly soliciting bids from private security and logistics firms. All of these are closed door deals. We don't know the contracts or any of the oversight that went through the government. But among them that got awarded a large contract was Safe Reach Solutions, which was ran by the CIA guy, Philip Riley, and incorporated in November of 2024. In January of 2025, we reported on the UGS Solutions manning the Gaza checkpoints. So we know that they began sometime in January, where American mercenaries had begun manning the checkpoints in Gaza. February 2025 is when GHF, their document leaked. They were registered in 2025 in Sweden, because a lot of NGOs register in Sweden for some reason, a lot of these weird charities. Their full document is online, and I can post a link to it later if you guys want it. But the important part is that they went over and who the board members were. And some of the board members are as follows. Nate Mook, who is the former CEO of World Central Kitchen. Now, if you guys remember, World Central Kitchen was bombed by Israel. They killed 7 workers, and a drone struck their truck after coordination with the IDF, that they would have known that they were there. So it's interesting that a guy who lost 7 of his employees to Israel is now working in private with them, but whatever. He's also a special advisor on Ukraine to think tanks in the United States. Interesting. Raisa Scheinberg, who is the vice president in government affairs and policy at MasterCard, also worked as a senior advisor at the Department of the Treasury and the Office of Terrorist Financing. And Jonathan Foster, who is the founder and managing director of Current Capital. Why are all of these bankers on the board of the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation? We'll find out. We'll keep going. So executive leadership, David Burke, who is the COO. He's the prior governor of South Carolina, and he served as the executive director of the World Food Program. And John Akrey, former head of USAID, response leader in Latin America when USAID was used as a front to try to overthrow the Venezuelan government. So just so you know, that's who's running it. Okay, so in the document, it outlined why GHF was created. It said traditional aid has failed in Gaza due to diversion, politics, and conflict. And we're proposing a new independent, secure, auditable model for delivering aid. And we've been talking about this a lot, especially in spaces, talking about how they convince you that whatever governments can do, private enterprise can do much better and much more efficiently. And they just convince you of that because they want the money.
Well, it's the old line of, you know, for, you know, healthcare, you know, just everything. We always learned that was always, you know, the typical free market line. And now that's been expanded out to things like, you know, these large institutions or large, you know, humanitarian funds or, security agencies and stuff like that.
Exactly. So they promise transparency and monitoring. It sounds great, right? So they promise independent audits, outside legal counsel, and real-time dashboards through their financial systems, which run through Truist, JP Morgan, and Goldman Sachs. So there's that. So we have a MasterCard board member working with JP Morgan and Goldman Sachs on the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. They reached out to various NGOs and wanted partnerships. Not a single NGO entered into a partnership with the GHF. Not one. None of the NGOs that we are familiar with in Gaza. On May 15th, as you guys know, we've discussed it on the show, Operation Gideon's Chariot started. And I put these two maps together because it shows you on the left, it shows you the evacuation zones And then on the right, it shows you where these aid distribution zones are. So if you can see, they're literal, I'm probably going to get demonetized, concentration camps.
Yep.
The aid centers are concentration camps to concentrate the population of Gaza around these sites.
Prioritize interests.
Right. And in this time, GHF personnel officially arrive in Gaza, even though we knew that they were been there and operating for a very long time. They start to aid in those staging those aid areas that we just showed. On, I think it was May 16th, so around there, Jake Wood, one of the leaders of GHF, resigns. He had said, "I won't participate in, I won't be part of displacing Palestinians," and urged the UN to participate in the plan. The UN has panned the plan, will not participate in it. And as you can see from the maps we just showed, this plan obviously intends to relocate the Gazans. So Jake Wood resigns. He says, "I unequivocally will not be a part of anything that forcibly dislocates or displaces the Palestinians." I'm sorry, he said that on the 16th, and then on the 25th, he resigned. And he said it because it was impossible to meet the foundation's objectives while strictly adhering to the humanitarian principles of humanity, neutrality, impartiality, and independence, which I will not abandon. And then he went on to urge Israel to let in more aid. Then they appointed John Acree to lead the whole entire outfit. How fitting, the USAID guy. But then I started digging a little bit more. And I found out, none other than the wonderful architect of Iraq, David Petraeus, is involved. David Petraeus is a former U.S. general. If you guys don't remember, some of our listeners are probably a little bit younger. He helped completely destroy Iraq and then was forced to resign from the CIA after he got caught telling his mistress secrets or something like that. Like, what are we doing here? What are we? All these disgraced people and bankers are just hanging out in Gaza. In April, he's named chairman of KKR Middle East, which is one of the world's largest private equity firms, which oversees billions in defense, surveillance, infrastructure investments. And guess what? They're involved with Eric Prince. They own part of his company. May 22nd, reports in Sheer Post and other outlets say he's involved in at least a minor role or possibly a secret board position in GHF. And I want you guys to watch this video. This is recent. I believe this is from April. I know it's from 2025, but I believe it's from April.
I believe there should be a vision for the future of the Palestinian people that is similar to the vision that we presented to the people of Iraq before we conducted the major operations that we did there during the surge. And we would go to the people of Fallujah and we would tell them in advance of our operation, we are going to make your lives better. We're going to do it by getting Al-Qaeda out of your neighborhoods. And then we're going to stay in those neighborhoods. We're going to create gated communities, essentially. It's an accurate description, but with much more effective walls. In fact, we would tell them, I said, look, you know, it costs a lot of money to be in a gated community in Florida, and we're going to give it to you for free here in Fallujah.
Crazy. They're going to give you a free gated community in Rafah, in Fallujah, Raqqa, Aleppo.
The funniest part is, when Jake Wood was like, unequivocally, I will not be a part of anything. You know, when people are like, I will not be part of anything that does this. And they're like, okay, then you just won't be a part of this because we're still doing this. They just had to resign.
Yes. And I mean, I commend the guy for, I guess, sticking to his principles. But at the same time, what did you think was going to happen getting involved with Israel? Why are we still like playing these games?
Yeah.
And what the gated community? Like, I can't with these people. And he's a liberal. Gated community. We're going to give you a gated community in Fallujah. You know how much it costs for a gated community in Florida? You're getting one for free.
So, I mean, is this what globalism looks like? I mean, this is globalism in action.
It's really great. Globalism, imperialism, whatever you want to call it.
And the funny thing is that, we did see a sort of, like a, a golden age for online scammers, right? With the Gaza aid funds and fundraisers and stuff like that. And it's similar to the way that, you know, during the Crusades, when the West did get that and pilgrims would make the pilgrimage on the way there, essentially, you know, there was a whole lot of scamming going on where, you know, you claim to be a pilgrim going on the way to the Holy Land. And so, you know, either you collect donations based off that, or, you know, people get robbed. So anyway, there was a lot of money that flowed to the Middle East or to the Holy Land in kind of this similar way where people utilize, you know, this, you know, I'm going to the Holy Land. Do you want to give any money? Or, you know, I'm collecting money to take to the Holy Land, and people scamming off of this and scamming off of our attachment to, you know, this area. And the other funny thing is, you know, as you mentioned, you know, the banking executives here, modern banking, if I'm not mistaken, was kind of built off this because it became dangerous for certain pilgrims to travel along the road to the Holy Land. And so part of the way that they had invented, you know, credit or banking was this way that you know, had a value that you know, if you could deposit something in one place and then have the same value of that and given to you at another place.
I gotcha.
It's like a rough form of banking. And so anyway, this comes about once again because of money flowing to the Holy Land and so many scammers and robbers along the road that were robbing these priests and pilgrims.
That's why Murat's my co-host, because he can give you the most ridiculous and random history about, you want to know where banditry came from? You want to know where GoFundMe scams came from? The Crusades.
Yeah.
Only here on DDG. Only here. So on May 27th, we get our first day of operations in Gaza by the GHF, and we're told that it's going to be the biggest, best aid distribution center. Glorious, but promises not kept. Let's see what happens.
Muhammad, Barmana.
موتوا حرام اللي بسير انتوا بياخذوا ولدعيتنا بياخذ وبالعادي لميت عن الارض انا لمم عن الارض حرام اللي بسير هذا انا عمل مية جاي من غزة عشان الولد
قبل ساعة قالوا لنا بدهم يفتحوا السليم نروح نجيب اكل من جوا وصلنا قبل الساعة اللي قالوا فيها دخلوا الناس قالوا لهم خذوا اللي بدكم اياه بسرعة عشان تصير فوضى ونفس الناس اللي سلمت هم اللي طخوا علينا لقمة مغمسة بالدم يعني يا انت بتموت يا ابنك بموت عشان ناكل مش حياة هذه
زي يوم القيامة زي يوم الحج 50,000 واحد لا صحة لك علبة فاصوليا وعلبة بازيلا بقيت شيئا زي هيك وتخبيها انا اجري سبب الطحين لا في طحين ولا في رز ولا في مساعدات ولا في مؤسسة عليك تسليم مش عادل نقول له تعالوا على الهوية جبت هويتي معي اساس استلم على الهوية
just absolute pandemonium just no organization just gates falling. Eyewitnesses say the crowd control was obviously minimal, as you guys can also see. Reports indicate there were no biometric registrations. They hadn't been installed yet. This is very typical of American and Israeli governments to not do anything that they said they were going to do. It was just physical aid distribution. After only 8,000, now remember, these sites are supposed to service 300,000 people with at least two meals a day. After 8,000 boxes of aid, chaos inevitably ensued. Reports state that at least one person was killed, with multiple others injured. Journalists on the ground described the scene as a failed military checkpoint dressed up as humanitarian aid. These sorts of assaults continued. There were also reports of an Israeli helicopter that fired on people waiting for aid. And Al Jazeera came forward, you think, yesterday and stated 14 people have been killed and at least 40 injured at these checkpoints alone. I also want to tell you guys to look at this article up, and I'll put the link in the chat. Let me just share my screen really quickly. This article by Leila Sansour, Starvation and the Final Test of Why of Impunity, Why Israel is Willing to Pay the Price in Gaza. And it's really, it's a little bit of a black pill, but I really, really, really agree with what she discusses in this article about the dehumanization and the actual strategy and why Israel does not care anymore. So just.
And then that's the calculation, right? Is that they're attempting to starve them out? The
I think that Operation Gideon's Chariots is an attempt or intends to hold 75% of Gaza within the next 2 months. So the object right now is to push as many Palestinians as they can down south towards Rafah. I am black-pilled in this conflict big time, so I wholeheartedly believe they want to push them into the Sinai, basically pushing them as hard as they can up against this wall until the wall has no choice but to break or they die. So I do think that they're trying to push them into the Sinai. But for now, they're doing it under the guise of we want the aid to be organized and Hamas can't get hold of this aid. Because God forbid Hamas gets a hold of one box of aid. It's all for naught.
To the Sinai. I imagine their main objective was just to clear the population out and to kind of put pressure on, you know, the surrounding states to take the people. It sounds like did you mean that literally in a sense of, you know, when they're up against the wall, or are you just kind of speaking figuratively for
both? I mean, they'll push them up against that until Egypt is really left with no choice, or somebody's left with no choice but to step in. I mean, they're cramming them into these zones. They're tiny. They're incredibly tiny. And a lot of them just live on the beach now because the coast is where they're allowed to be. We've been talking this way for months that people probably think it's the boy who cried wolf, but it's getting to the point of where it's not sustainable. Well, it hasn't been sustainable for a while, but it's getting to the point where it's ready to break. They have less than 1,000 military contractors and they're trying to distribute aid to what they say is 1.9 million people. How was this even put forth as a plan?
It's a huge population, you know.
But like we were talking about this earlier, about the bankers on May 29th, Gray Zone reported a really, really great article, if you guys haven't read it, but pointed out that on May 27th, Avigdor Lieberman sent out a tweet that said, the money for humanitarian aid comes from the Mossad and the Ministry of Defense, hundreds of millions of dollars at the expense of Israeli citizens. Typical to be upset about the money from Israeli citizens for the situation that you created. You kicked the UN out where we were all paying for the aid of Gazans. You kicked them out. And now you complain that you have to pay for them to survive. Well, they have to live for you to kill them the right way, right?
Oy vey, I can't believe my old son is going to ask for my last $50.
You're gonna get demonetized. Yair Lapid, another crazy member of the Knesset, he's the de facto leader of the opposition, accused the Israeli government of funding two shell companies, GHF and Safe Reach Solutions, are being funded by the Israeli government. Philip Riley, the guy we talked to that developed he was quoted as developing a great relationship with Bibi and the Israeli government, is being funded by Mossad and the Ministry of Defense. So The gray zone alleges, and I think that they're probably spot on, is that this is a huge money laundering operation run by the Israelis. A leaked internal GHF document acknowledged that the food distribution centers and residential compounds it was constructing in Gaza could be perceived as concentration camps with biometrics. So they knew that these were going to be looked at as concentration camps, and they are already on the war path to make sure that we don't talk about them in this sense. What else was found was a job advertisement for UG Solutions, which, just have a look here. These are the people that are responsible for distributing aid. Can anybody tell me why they need to be in excellent physical condition, able to operate in high threat environments, advanced combat skills, highest level of weapons proficiency, small arms and rifles is required, snipers skilled in unconventional warfare tactics, prior experience in conflict zones, 4 years or more active duty, four or more combat deployments. Why would a private aid distribution company need people of this with these characteristics?
I wonder who's the HR recruiter for who types up that one or who screens these. That's incredible.
And it's still up. The job posting is still up. So if you want to go snipe Palestinians, I guess they'll apply. I don't know. So the CEO, as we said earlier, Jake Wood, he resigned. It was big to do. But quietly, David Burke resigned as well. And then the Swiss board member got up and quit. Nate Mook now denies any involvement at all, even though he was listed in the GHF sanction, like their own written document that he was a board member. So the rats are jumping ship, denying they ever had anything to do with it. But it's still going. It's still going on. And then on May 29th, Sweden says that GHF violated several laws for foundations registered in that country. So they had to run. And where did they run to? Delaware. Because that's where Trump told them to go. Very interesting place to register your business. You know who else registered their businesses in Delaware and told everyone else to? Elon Musk. Just saying. Anyway, no sales tax, and they're really lax on businesses. I don't know, whatever. But now the Trump administration still has not commented on this other than to say so much aid is getting into Gaza, more aid, the biggest aid, so much aid, they don't even know what to do with it. What the fuck are we doing here?
Yeah, I mean the concentration camp angle is, you know, even if you told me prior to this war that, okay, you know, Israel wants to clear you know, Gaza out, or, you know, Gaza's a problem for Israel, this whole angle of like the concentration camps and the you know, biometrics, I mean, you know, one can only presume, you know, what that's referring to. What am I to think that, you know, this is all, is this like the organ harvesting? Like is that what is implied here? You know, and I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. And, you know, of course, you know, considering the, you know, the history of the nation, the idea of there being, you know, concentration camps and, you know, where stuff was, or, you know, things were collected, or, you know, whether it being, you know, bio data or, you know, anything else. It boggles the mind. I don't know. I couldn't even begin to think for.
Oh, and just a side note, those biometrics and all of that, who do you think's helping with that? Palantir. Who did Trump just give a couple billion dollar contract to look at our data and everything about us? Palantir. So.
And they're going to get their hands on 23andMe's, you know, database eventually, and
They have ISIS database already, and Trump just gave them access to everything. So all that data that, I don't want to go too far off because we're out of time, but all that data that was harvested through the DOGE operations is now belongs to Palantir. And then they're operating in Gaza. They're also operating in Ukraine. Not so much Palantir. It's more Anduril, but still. It's the same people.
They'll be global. I mean, they'll be operating.
But the globalists are evil.
Yeah, of course, right? Yeah, they'll be operating. Here's the thing: they'll be operating as their own sovereign state. I mean, eventually, the idea
that is the idea.
State is, you know, the state that's sovereign in the cloud or whatever, but not, you know, within the existing nation states.
Exactly. They've tried it, and maybe our viewers don't know. They've tried to develop a cloud state, and it didn't. It can't happen. So they're trying to create havens inside of real states. Namely Honduras and El Salvador, but Gaza's probably not too far off, especially with all of their crypto deals in the Gulf now and all of the big, beautiful Trump properties popping up all over the place. I've ranted enough, I think. Any final thoughts, Murat?
I don't have anything else on Gaza. As for Ukraine or Russia, do you have any predictions for tomorrow? I'm thinking there's a whole nothing.
What? I'm thinking there. What do you mean a whole nothing? Oh, you mean the peace talks?
The peace talks. Yeah, Istanbul. Yeah.
Piss talks are going nowhere. Piss talks are going nowhere. They just said thank you, FaZe Will. They just said that they'll comment on everything tomorrow, so they will not be. They will not be giving any the negotiating delegation will not be giving any comments tonight. But I don't think that any negotiations take place.
Likewise, as for Glenn Greenwald, Palantir, make sure to check out our spaces. Sarah's been just swishing everything from the field this week on the spaces. There's been some really good ones and some really good conversations about. Some of the stuff that we discuss on here and Palantir and AI and tech.
And weird journalists doing weird things in weird settings. We don't talk about that on the show because this is a very professional and straight-laced program. So we leave that stuff for this basis.
And we wouldn't be able to clip that anyway. So
guys, I literally read the script to a sex tape in a space. So if you're not attending our spaces, you're absolutely missing out on some pretty ridiculous commentary. And thank you so much, Dino, for your support. And we will continue to report because I'm fascinated by these little techno bro cults and this crypto community and these degenerates. They're so yucky, but it's like a car crash. I can't look away. Guys, please keep in your thoughts all of the Gazans trying to get fed and not die, and all of the Russians that were harmed in this morning's terror attacks, and the one on Kursk, or sorry, Bryansk. There was another terror attack in Kursk, by the way. There was a train attack. We may see you on Thursday, since it's obviously ramping up to be quite a busy week. But other than that, check us out in the spaces. We'll be uploading this to all of your favorite Spotify and podcast platforms and whatever, whatnots and what have yous. We're in discussions to maybe start a new show that will talk more about the gross antics of journalists in Brazil and what that means for the media market. But other than that, we will see you guys around, and I hope you guys have an awesome week. Keep on, I don't even know. Keep on blackpilling.
Just keep swimming. Yeah. That's what you were going to say, was keep on swimming. Swimming?
I don't swim.
All right. Well, we'll see you next week, guys. Take care.